We'll get them in order here.
No, they don't.
Good morning, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. What we're going to do is take care of some public hearings, possible work sessions. And I also want to give word now that we had a work session scheduled for Senate Bill 89. My understanding is there's another amendment that's going to give a little more clarity that will be coming forward. And so the work session that's scheduled for today for 89 will be carried over. Do we have a date for that?
Or not yet, Mr. Chairman.
So we'll reset it once we get possession of the new amendment. So with that, we're going to go ahead and start with, I'm going to do things a little bit different today. I want to start from the bottom of the list and work up on the public hearings. Just to shake it up, it's kind of like A to Z. We can go from Z to A. It's Monday anyway. So open the public hearing on Senate Bill 373. And Council, do you want to give us an overview?
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 373 comes from Senator Bonamici. Makes an employer liable to an employee when the employer fails to pay the Support Enforcement Division in a timely manner, wages being withheld as a result of the Support Enforcement Order. Chair, members of the committee, this comes as a result of a case of Redason versus Karahashi. I'm butchering that pronunciation. Where the person whose wages were being withheld, the employer did not forward them in a timely manner. The person was subject, the employee was subject to penalties and everything else. And because of the literal reading of the statute, the court was not able to award the person damages.
All right. Senator Bonamici, comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I just wanted to introduce this bill on behalf of my constituent, Brett Arvison. I'm Suzanne Bonamici from Senate District 17, and Brett Arvison is a constituent of mine who contacted me a little more than a year ago with his story of what really has been a sort of ongoing nightmare for him of misplaced justice, because Brett's a hardworking, loyal parent and was paying child support through his employer, but the employer actually had some cash flow problems and was using the money to help with their cash flow problems instead of sending it to his child. And so Brett has tried many different avenues to remedy that and ended up in the Court of Appeals. He won at the trial court level, but the Court of Appeals case was sort of a textbook example. If you remember when we had the justices here to talk about legislative history and statutory interpretation, the case was a textbook example of that. They actually went back and listened to some of the tapes from the House Judiciary Committee when the statute was passed and found that that statute only allowed a remedy if the employer withheld in excess. And because Brett's employer didn't withhold in excess, they withheld and didn't pay the money on time, but eventually paid the money. Even though Brett had suffered damages, he was not entitled to recover those. So this bill is designed to clarify that that situation, and that if there is a noncompliance, that doesn't just include withholding amounts in excess of the amount specified, but also failing to pay in time. So that's what Senate Bill 373 does, and Brett is here to testify about it, and I believe the Department of Justice is here as well, and I do have some written testimony that I'll be providing to you for your files. And I believe it's really critical that if innocent and responsible parents like Brett Arvison have their credit damaged, and as you'll hear from him, passports and professional licenses threatened, they should be entitled to recover their damages. So I hope you'll join me in supporting this bill. Thank you.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and call Brett Arvison.
Arvison
and Ronell Schenkel up, please. Please give us your name and then your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, good morning. My name is Brett Arvidson. I live at 12340 Southwest Faircrest. I support Senate Bill 373 with Amendment Number 1 for protecting innocent noncustodial parents from injustice and expediting critical trial support to Oregon's children. I hope my story illustrates how employers exploit payroll deduction system. In 2001, I started working for an engineering company called Karahashi & Associates. Routinely, the Washington County District Attorney issued a wage withholding order. and Kurahashi began deducting the child support from my paycheck. Shortly thereafter, I received a notice from the district attorney indicating my account was seriously in arrears and threatening an enforcement action. I originally thought it was a mistake and immediately sent a letter to the DA with the supporting pay stubs, which showed I was actually owed an $80 refund. I then received a memorable call from the DA stating that evidently Kurahashi was keeping deducted amounts. And when I suggested they contact Mr. Kurahashi about the arrearage, she told me that it was state policy not to enforce legal orders against employers, and they would continue action against me. When I demanded a hearing, she informed me that I could not contest an enforcement action. I then met with Greg Kurahashi and gave him a letter describing the impacts of his activities on my family, and I asked him to stop. Greg gave some vague promises, but argued the order was an issue between the state and Kurahashi. Eventually, the arrearage was paid, but the next payment was a month late. During my tenure at Kurahashi & Associates, 64 out of 82 payments were 1 to 4 months late. In one instance, the Child Support Division received 7 payments on the same day. During that period, the state destroyed my credit rating, charged me enforcement fees, seized a tax return, allowed the IRS to reduce my exemptions, threatened to garnish my bank accounts, and threatened to revoke my engineer's license. The most painful memory involves my daughter, my stepdaughter, and my mother interrogating me about the problem. I felt alienated from my family and punished for my hard work. Throughout this period, I kept calling the DA and sending letters demanding action against Kurahashi. They continued to refuse to acknowledge the order. I kept confronting Kurahashi and kept hearing, "It's perfectly legal." After leaving Kurahashi, I spent several months in circuit court and tax court trying to resolve the consequences, and this round of litigation resulted in thousands of dollars in damages. Then I actually read the language on my wage withholding order in ORS 25-424. The holder of support rights, the obligor, the child support division, or a district attorney may bring action against the withholder. Based on those plain words, I initiated action against Kurahashi. We became the case of first impression and the only case of record for ORS 25-424. The state of Oregon has never enforced a single wage withholding order. And during the trial, the DOJ reported over 1,000 employers were known to abuse child support funds. We pursued the litigation in circuit court, the Court of Appeals, and to the Oregon Supreme Court. The DOJ submitted amicus briefs defending Kurahashi & Associates during my Supreme Court petition. Sadly, the appeals court overruled the plain language of the statute. Senate Bill 373 with Amendment Number 1 addresses punishment of innocent parents, provides a legal recourse, and sends a message that exploiting child support funds will not be tolerated. Paragraphs 2 and 3, I'm talking about the amended paragraphs, by the way, benefits both custodial and non-custodial parents to ensure their child get their critical support. Amendment Number 1 contains Paragraph 3D, which provides the next innocent parent in my situation a recourse when the employer refuses to withhold or pay as required. Non-custodial parent earns the wages, maintains the liability for the debts, and has the moral right to defend their children. The damage liability in paragraph 3D includes recovery of exploited funds, which can be forwarded to the Child Support Division for satisfaction of arrears or refunded to the damaged parent. Paragraph 3D provides the non-custodial parent the right of action in any wage abuse situation. And paragraph 3D recovers the damages when the obligor's credit rating is trashed, tax returns seized, license revoked, service charges assessed, garnishments, and other damages. My court case addressed excess withholding, and I must comment that my history was not, the more common practice here is employers seizing the deducted funds. So I would ask the legislature to give the full spectrum of support here. I really feel strongly that action should not be predicated on excess withholding. Paragraphs 4 and 5 provide definite penalties for willful abuse of child support. An employer abusing child support funds should receive harsh punishment. Paragraphs 4 also allows the Department of Child Support, the DAs, to bring action on behalf of either parent. I hope an obligor will never have to use paragraph 3. I sincerely hope that the agency issuing the orders will enforce the orders that benefit hundreds of thousands of Oregon children. In my case, a big problem could have kept at a small problem. Getting divorced is not a criminal conviction. The law requires 250,000 non-custodial parents to enroll in the wage withholding without any payment history at all. Payroll deduction accounts for two-thirds of child support, or approximately $225 million per year. Most non-custodial parents work hard for their children and deserve the benefit of doubt mandated by constitutional due process. We lack that basic right now. Child support arrears do exist in this country, but mostly result from poverty and not child abandonment. A recent federal study showed that 80% of child support debt belongs to people with less than $15,000 a year annual income. States virtually collect all arrears from parents with more than $20,000 in annual income. Today we face a period of high unemployment with the 25 to 34-year-old age group hit hardest. This unemployment will result in child support arrears. These kids are not criminals, nor slackers, but are going through hard times. Our focus on enforcement fails during economic distress. Hope the Department of Justice and the legislature can find alternate mechanisms to help both custodial and non-custodial parents during these difficult times. In the packet, I did include a flyer on the state of Missouri's Fair Share program, which is, I think, a good way to help non-custodial parents. I ask the Senate Judiciary Committee to make the right decision for Oregon's children. Please pass Senate Bill 373 with Amendment Number 1. Thank you for this opportunity to speak, and I'm available for questions.
All right, thank you. Before we take questions, we'll hear from Ronnell Schenkel.
And members of the committee, I'm Ronnell Schenkel with the Attorney General's Office, here today in support of Senate Bill 373. Mr. Arvidsson has done a good job of laying out the details of his case, which I became familiar with, I think, somewhat late in the process, unfortunately. But nonetheless, as you've heard, there are some civil remedies that are intended to be available to parents involved in the child support program and working with employer income withholding, and we have discovered that there is, well, I should say the court has discovered that there is a loophole in those laws. It is correct, based on some of the information that he was sharing with you, although I don't have the same statistics in front of me today, that income withholding is the absolute most common form of enforcement and collection of child support, not only in Oregon, but in all of the states. Thousands of income withholdings are generated by the program automatically, almost, through a computerized system. We work in very close partnership in Oregon, as many of you know, based on the laws that you have passed with us and for us over the past 10 to 20 years with employers. And as such, we have a section in our Department of Justice Division of Child Support, a centralized section separate from those district attorney's offices called the Employer Assistance Desk. That is the location where we attempt to do direct outreach to employers and work with them when problems such as this occur. Because of that, our first line of offense and defense is to pick up the phone and call employers and make sure they understand what's going on, understand their income withholding, and are withholding correctly. My recall on this case is that we made several calls to this employer, and very similarly to what Mr. Arvidsson was experiencing as an employee, we were experiencing the same sort of, we'll listen, we'll send something in, and then it happened again. So our general outreach through our employer assistance was not effective in this case. In a past legislative session, the Department of Justice and the Bureau of Labor and Industries amended this particular law and thought we had fixed all of these issues so that obligors and obligees could be made whole when an employer misused the funds. Clearly, we did not get all of the scenarios. Just by way of a repeat then, what is currently in the statute, according to Mr. Arvidsson's court case, is that if an employer simply fails to withhold, there's an action available in court. If an employer withholds incorrectly and does not follow the law, there's an action and a remedy available. And if they withhold and simply never send in the funds, there is an action and a remedy available. The loophole is this employer was withholding, and they eventually were sending in the funds. So we didn't have a specific area of the law to point to, and that is the experience that Mr. Robertson had. I do want to clarify one piece of information on behalf of the program, and I've talked with Senator Bonamici about this. When this language is amended, presuming that you pass this bill, it will be clear to us that the child support program will initiate an action in court for this type of a situation upon the request of either the obligor or the obligee. We are unable, however, to represent from that point forward the obligor or obligee because we cannot represent individual citizens. However, we are absolutely the accounting and record keeper in these cases and should be available to appear as a witness as necessary in these instances. since we contain the complete accounting records and the timing of payments coming in and income withholdings going out. So we're supportive of this bill. I have not seen the Dash 1 amendments, so can't speak to those today, but I'm available for any questions if you have them.
Thank you. Questions?
Senator Boquist first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said that you cannot initiate action on behalf of the individual.
Chair Pozanski and Senator Boquist, we can initiate an action in court, but from that point, we can't literally represent or stand in the shoes of the obligor or the obligee. So we can facilitate the motion in court, get it started, we can appear as a witness, but we can't speak on behalf of them. Good point of clarification.
Are you following up on that question there? Because if not, I've got something to follow up. Ronell, so this is, make sure we got this on the record. So basically, this would be a motion in the proceeding that's already pending before the court, or let's say before the court. So it's not a new action that's being started as a lawsuit. It's just enforcement of the judgment that's already been rendered.
Actually, Chair Prozanski, this would be a new judicial action in a manner. We would already have a judgment on record, on file in the court, and we would be taking administrative enforcement actions. By way of reminder, our income withholdings are administrative actions issued by the program and not filed in the court. So our motion, at the request of one of the parties, would be to get it before the judge at that point. So that discussion could occur about not only the amount not withheld or withheld incorrectly, but any damages to the parties, and I think that's the key issue.
All right. So in this situation, once the action was commenced, then in this case, the payor would need to be coming in and basically putting forward that I have paid through my showing the receipts, check receipts, and then basically having the, I guess the employer, lack of better terms, to be showing that they either paid the money on or defending why they didn't.
Chair Prozanski, that's correct. And we would come in with the accounting records indicating the date that we actually received payments from the employer.
Okay. Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Prozanski. I guess the first question is, why are you not already doing that?
Chair Prozanski and Senator Wissett, it was not clear to the Child Support Program that we had the ability to initiate these actions. As I said, I was involved in the case late in the process and can only offer my apologies to Mr. Robertson at the point that he came to my attention. We maybe could have found the flexibility. This is going to make it very clear to all of the practitioners in the program that we can bring these cases forward.
Thank you. Yeah. It's almost as if you're hunting mosquitoes with a howitzer I see this as a necessity. I also see it as an unfunded mandate on the employer, and it makes it very difficult, particularly for small employers to do this, I would think. Are the employers actually compensated for withholding this money?
Chair Prozanski, Senator Witt, a very good question. In Chapter 25, and by way of reminder, we have had income withholding in place since welfare reform in 1997. We work with the employers. They are allowed to charge, in Chapter 25, a fee for the withholding and processing on their end. That is not part of the state action. That's up to the individual employers whether or not they charge that fee for basically their administrative costs. We do initiate, as I said, based on an employer assistance scenario that we have, we initiate an income withholding that does the calculations for them as much as we can, indicates the amount to withhold, when to withhold. We try to make it as simple as we can. We are available for training. We are available for technical assistance. The only calculation that they literally have to do is similar to when they're figuring out, for example, Mr. Arbitson's taxes for that paycheck. They do have to check and make sure they're leaving him, for example, with minimum wage and those types of things, much as they do with other withholdings. But the income withholding specifically, they get most of the detail in that order that we send to them and any follow-up support that they need from the Department of Justice.
One further question on are you looking at employers who have made an error, or are you looking at employers who have made a fraudulent effort to take the money and use it for a while before they pass it on? And how do you distinguish between the two?
Chair Prozonsky and Senator Whitsett and Mr. Robertson may wish to also speak to this. On behalf of the Department of Justice and our employer assistance desk, we absolutely do not want to go after an employer who simply makes an error. We understand that we issue thousands of these withholdings. We know that they can be complicated, especially for a small employer if it's their first time doing one of these. We have that assistance desk to call, to talk to the owner, to talk to the bookkeeper, find out, was it an error? Was it a misunderstanding? We will document all of that type of contact and have a record of it and move forward without any type of civil action. What you heard, I think, in Mr. Everson's statistics is probably the number of contacts we get in the program about errors, intentional or unintentional, being made. I believe it is rare for us to have an employer that repeatedly does something as egregious as happened in Mr. Arvidsson's case. That's the good news. The bad news is when they do that, we don't have a strong enough law to allow for the obligor or the obligee to seek damages. So it is not about someone making an error or in good faith doing a withholding incorrectly. We will work with them to make that right. It is about those employers who are purposefully, for whatever reason, not following the law.
May I address that also? If you look at how the statute is written, if you go to sections 4 and 5, you really can't get attorney's fees until you prove willfulness and some malice in that process. So you may be damaged. And most times it's, in my case, it got out of control and it was huge amounts of money. Most time you're talking about a couple $100s. And you can't get, you're not going to pay $3,000 for an attorney to go after $200. So I think the system you have laid out is going to encourage dealing with this thing administratively. Most employers have, want to pay for their children. There's some bad apples out there. But I think the way you have it laid out in terms of going to enforcement and going to attorney's fees at that point, I think it's going to discourage, just people coming in and suing the employer for suing the employer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to clarify also that in the Oregonian article that's attached to Mr. Arvidsson's testimony, the reporter actually spoke with the attorney who represented the employer, and he said, in fact, it says he was refreshingly candid. My understanding is that they had cash flow problems. They were essentially borrowing on that money, using to pay expenses and making it up later. It's not appropriate. So you have a pretty egregious situation that happened there. I also wanted to clarify what the Dash 1 amendment does, which I did actually send to the Department of Justice before we had it drafted. It deals with just a clarification. Legislative Council believed that there was sufficient language in on page 2, section 3. A deals with amounts withheld in excess. B deals with damages suffered by withholding in excess, and C deals with damages suffered by the obligor by reason of the failure to pay within the time. Legislative Council thought that was probably sufficient, but just to be extra careful, we added what's in D in dash 1, which is any other damages suffered by the obligor by the reason of the failure of the person to withhold or pay as required by the order. So that's just to make it perfectly clear that it isn't limited to failure to pay excess. It's just to clarify that it would apply to damages suffered as a result of the failure to pay as required by the order. And I also want to clarify for the record, there was a change in the drafting of this. Legislative Council used the term person instead of withholder, and I just want to clarify, according to Legislative Council, that person does include a corporation or business that is the withholder.
Yep. It's like corporation law says,
right.
They are persons that
that's
never
right.
Die. Senator Bulkquist.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess a question of counsel or Senator Bonamici, so I understand this. And my company's involved. I probably have 3 or 4 people a month that fall into this category. We have a lot of part-time employees that come in and go. And what routinely happens is, I don't think ever in my history have I ever had an employee come to me and said, hey, I got a divorce. I had this garnishment or this payment coming. Never happens. It always shows up in a form letter from the Department of Justice. And then the very first thing is it shows up and says, deduct this amount, so on and so forth, which we're routinely familiar with. And then we try and call the employee because we get garnishments all the time, and some of them aren't really garnishments. They look like good judicial documents, but they're really collection agencies with no authority. And so you get a hold of the employee, and then you start deducting, and we send the checks in. I've never once had the Department of Justice call us on problems. I did just last week have them call and say, stop sending them money, though, because of an employee. But I guess my concern is understanding, is this change? Because, you know, many times an employer doesn't get the letter from the Department of Justice until, like, 3 months down the line, and now they're 3 months in arrears, frankly, in child support. And then we're supposed to try and figure out how to get the money from them, and they work part-time. How does... does this bill just focus on the egregious cases, like we're saying here, where they should have, pardon the pun, they should have hung the employer because obviously, but I'm a little concerned at the front end when we get started to this, what happens, because as you know, there's all kinds of things going on, and I wish employees were like the gentleman here who went to the employer and said, this is what I got going on, but never once in the last 20-some years have I ever had an employee come to me, and it's always their letter that shows up on my doorstep.
Yeah. Before Ms. Shankle responds, just I'm going to respond based on what I've heard, putting this on the record to see if I get this understood. Normally, the Department of Justice employer services, I forget what the terminology is going to actually be working with them, making sure administratively they have everything squared away. Clearly, if you receive a letter as the employer 3 months after the obligation has started and they've been employed, I would assume they are going to be looking for enforcement from that day forward and then potentially trying to collect whatever you might be able to collect that's in arrearage, but that's going to be through their administrative program.
Chair Prozanski, that in essence is correct. I can add more information if you'd like it, Senator Boquist.
It's just a concern I have because this happens fairly routinely, and we've always had, we always call the Department of Justice and have a good working relationship. Yep. I'm just trying to see if this law here is going to change that, and suddenly we're going to be draconian, because we need to be draconian in some cases, but the average employer is trying to comply with everything. It's strange enough, even though I would say these are good employees, I don't think it's odd. I think many employees, they just don't want to tell their employer that this is going to happen, and then when it happens, the employer's almost caught in the middle many times trying to deconflict.
Well, based on what I've heard, this is not going to be a I gotcha type of thing. It's going to be one that's going to, they're going to work, they're going to have a documentation that they've made out these outreaches, and the reality is they're not responding. All right. No, thank you. Question? I've got a lot of more bills I need to get through today.
Okay, a question would be, do you have in your administrative rules written, I don't see it in the statute, that there's that you will do, you will
handle
a mistake or a series of mistakes different than actual fraudulent action. Do you have in your administrative rules a statement somehow that you will in fact do this? I know what your intentions are, and I think your intentions are good, and very likely the Department of Justice will do just what you're saying. The statute will outlast us both.
Senator Witset, Senator Witset, I cannot confirm. I apologize. I don't have the administrative rule in front of me. I will certainly provide a copy to you and to committee counsel. I believe that is probably in our procedure manual and not in the rule itself, but I will check both of those and get them to you. Definitely the instruction to our staff is to do outreach to the employer first. We need them as a partner. We don't want to be heavy-handed with them, but I will find that information for you. And then, Chair Prozanski, if I might, my apologies that I didn't see the amendment. We have no problem with the Dashboard amendments.
Thank you. All right, any other questions? Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 373? Not seeing anyone coming up. I'm closing the public hearing on 373, and I'll be opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 100. Council.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 100 requires the Department of Corrections beginning in 2012 and every 6 years thereafter to conduct a study to determine the actual costs incurred by each county in providing management, support, services, supervision, and sanctioning felonies under the supervision of the county. Mr. Chairman, as a committee, you have a Dash 1 amendments in front of you, but they've been withdrawn.
They've been withdrawn?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right. So I've got six people that are currently set up. I'm going to bring up a panel of three. I'm going to do the first three, which I hopefully will be the first that need to be speaking. Ginger Martin, Diana Simpson, and Steve Berger. That will be followed by Paul Snyder, Tim Nesmith, and if Joe O'Leary, if Joe's here, I didn't see him earlier, but maybe Tim's going to cover that.
Good morning, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. I am Ginger Martin, Assistant Director for Transitional Services at the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 100. Senate Bill 100 places in statute a requirement that the Department of Corrections conduct an actual cost study of community corrections every 6 years beginning in 2012. The bill was written to carry out a recommendation of the Governor's Task Force on Federal Forest Payments and County Services. The actual cost study gives us the information that would be necessary to adjust state funding for community corrections to today's costs and the true cost of carrying out that responsibility, and in so doing provides some stability to the local criminal justice system. I would urge you to support Senate Bill 100. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
All right, thank you. Diana?
Good morning, Chair Prozanski and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Diana Simpson. I am the Sheriff of Benton County and representing Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Benton County is one of about 14 counties in the state that include community corrections in their sheriff's office. Community corrections has been a part of the sheriff's office in Benton County since 1984, and at that time, I was a parole and probation officer with the sheriff's office. Over the years, I can recall only two times an actual cost study was conducted on the operations of field supervision of offenders. The most recent cost study was conducted just over 3 years ago. This last cost study established a per offender cost for supervision, correctional treatment programs, and services and community-based sanctions necessary to manage the population. Community corrections is a cost-effective program and costs as much as 10 times less than the cost of prison. Senate Bill 100 would require a cost study be conducted by the Department of Corrections every 6 years. This would ensure that counties are appropriately compensated based on current and true costs of supervision. In the private sector, businesses will periodically determine if the product they are selling is true to the cost of producing the item. Just as the private sector does not want to lose money on their product, conducting periodic community corrections cost studies will determine the true cost of supervision. It's important that as partners in supervision of offenders, the state should be able to assure their county partners that they will be appropriately compensated, and the counties should be able to assure the state partners that they are receiving a good return on their investment. An actual cost study will provide an objective and practical approach to determining what is appropriate compensation. Thank you.
Steve.
Chair Prozanski and members of the Judiciary, my name is Steve Berger. I'm the Director of Community Corrections for Klamath and Lake County. I'm also President of the Oregon Association for Community Correction Directors. Senate Bill 100 honors the state-county partnership in operating community correction programs by requiring the Department of Corrections to conduct a cost study for community corrections beginning in 2012 and every 6 years thereafter. The purpose is to determine actual funding case rates used to develop budgets for grants provided by the state to operate community correction programs. This is a proven, accurate, transparent funding model that the 2005-2007 legislature adopted for community corrections and implementing the actual cost model. I want to emphasize this was a model that was developed in partnership with all 36 counties participating, and I think it provides a very simple, accurate model for determining the cost of community corrections. From my experience in some of these conversations relative to state and county partnerships specific to the funding, it's often very confusing to even have the conversations. Where does this dollar go? How do we determine what this dollar is for? And I believe Department of Corrections and Community Corrections in partnership with all 36 counties have developed a model that is very simple. It's very clear and transparent what the cost is and what it's for, and establishes a per head cost for community supervision. Without elaborating any further on what Sheriff Simpson and Ginger Martin have already said, I think it's easy to say that community corrections is a cost-effective model, And at this point, we can say that it's also 70% of Oregon's 34,000 offenders, felony offenders under parole and post-prison supervision, do not reoffend within 3 years. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair, brief question. Thank you, Chair. Question of Sheriff Simpson, just very briefly. This sets out the study, and then after the Department of Corrections studied, and I asked them this question, and they didn't really have an answer. But you do the study. There's no teeth in this. There's no guarantee that they're going to come back and apply this study. Do you have a lot of faith in the Department of Corrections they're going to do that, or should there have been teeth in this bill that says study it and then apply it?
Senator Prezansky and Senator Boquist, I think that, especially given the current economic times, I think everybody has to be an understanding partner. But I think what this does is that at least it takes lets us take a look at what are we really spending on the cost of supervision. And it could be that, you know, with the new programs, new technology even, maybe it stays the same, maybe it goes up, and, you know, I doubt it will go down, but, you know, it could. I think it just gives everybody an equal playing ground in which to operate from and make decisions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator, to follow up on Senator Boquist's question, Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that community corrections perhaps aren't all equal. Some work better than others. And do the community corrections in general have any key performance measures that they must follow in order to get their grants? And are there any evidence-based practices that are required? And how are they established for the community corrections to get those grants?
Chair Prezansky, Senator DeWitsit, if I may respond. Community Corrections has established benchmarks that we do measure our performance. In fact, the Department of Corrections has those listed on a web-based site that somebody can access our benchmarks and we can see our progress. Some of those benchmarks are things such as recidivism, payment of restitution, participation in treatment, and successful closures of supervision. Those benchmarks can be monitored through the website in a fairly simple visual effect. If we're meeting the benchmark, there's a green light. If we're within 5% of the baseline of establishing that, there's a yellow light. And if we're not meeting those benchmarks, there's a red light. So it's a fairly easy model to follow and see if a particular county is or how their progress is being made towards those benchmarks. I also believe Community Corrections, in partnership with the Department of Corrections, is making significant progress on implementing the legislature's Senate Bill 267 that specifically identifies state resources, state funds used for treatment must be evidence-based practice and cost-effective. While I don't have the Senate Bill 267 progress report in front of me, I can say that it's my general understanding that we have exceeded, as a profession, we've exceeded the benchmark set forth by the legislature that outlined the progress report. So there were certain percentages outlined. Ginger might be able to help me out there.
All right.
But I believe we've exceeded those benchmarks that were originally sent out.
Thank you for putting that on the record, Steve. Appreciate it.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you all very much for your testimony. My next panel is Paul Snyder, Tim Nesbitt, and I don't know if Joe's here or not. Okay, so those two. Is there anyone else who wanted to be giving testimony today on Senate Bill 100?
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt. I'm Deputy Chief of Staff to the Governor and chaired his Federal Forest Payments Task Force. I'm providing to you for background an executive summary of our task force report, full copies of which will be back from the printer and distributed to all members later this week. But I do want to point out that, as Ms. Martin testified, this legislation originated as a recommendation from our task force, one of many, but in fact one of few where there's really very little cost. In fact, not any fiscal impact at all, as we can see, for the coming biennium. commit to updating this study. With counties facing a loss of $210 million in annual revenue once these payments cease, and already on a phase-down schedule, which is demonstrated in the second chart in the executive summary I just provided to you, that will put them at a crisis point before the end of the next biennium in the spring of 2011. We think it's important now to try and act on recommendations from our task force report, like this one, which do not incur any significant expenditure in 09-11, but can set us up to prepare for the loss of these payments and align state policy in ways in which counties will be better able to maintain service levels when these payments decline and eventually cease in the following biennium.
Great. Thank you. Paul.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. I think all the previous witnesses have already covered the major points. I would just like to express our appreciation once again to Mr. Nesbitt and to the governor for the task force and the work of the task force. I think Mr. Nesbitt is now a certified county expert, and we appreciate the fact that he's worked on this issue.
All right, thank you. Questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Since there's no one else who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 100, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing at this time. I'm going to go ahead and open up our public hearing on Senate Bill 99. Council, when you're ready.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Committee, Senate Bill 99 allows testing of a person with a history of drug or alcohol abuse who is on probation to be tested in the presence of the substance in the person's system by testing method that would include a breath or urine test, but would not be limited to these methods. Currently, the test is done by a breathalyzer or a blood test. Chairman of the committee, the bill comes to you at the request of the Department of Corrections.
All right, now I have Mark, is it Kadopti? I'm part of, and Steve Berger. And Mark, if you'll help me with your spelling or your pronunciation of your last name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Kadat.
Kadat.
I'm the Community
Thank
Corrections
you.
Chief of the State of Oregon Department of Corrections. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 99. What Senate Bill 99 would allow is for a variety of new drug and alcohol testing procedures for persons on probation supervision. The current statute limits testing to urine and breath tests. By removing this limitation, we can allow new technology in drug and alcohol testing, such as saliva and hair testing. Now, there are advantages to incorporating additional methods of testing. For example, urine testing is gender specific. Therefore, a female staff member must administer the test for a female probationer. By using hair or saliva testing, the administration is not gender specific. It's less intrusive and more timely. In addition, the use of hair testing reflects a longer period of potential drug and alcohol abuse. Just as a note, the conditions of post-prison supervision and parole are established by rule and not by statute, so there are no other statutes that would require this modification. ORS 137.540, subsection 1C, currently states, submit to testing of breath or urine for controlled substance or alcohol use. This legislative proposal would simply delete of breath or urine so that the condition would read, submit to testing for controlled substance use. Thank you for your time and consideration, Mr. Bill.
Thank you, Steve.
Senator Pruzanski, members of the judiciary, since Mr. Kadat has already done the heavy lifting there, giving the detail on the bill, I just simply want to state that the Association of Community Correction Directors is supporting this bill. It's viewed, for those of us in the field, as a housekeeping issue, updating the ORSs in keeping with current technologies that allow us to perform the testing on a, as Mr. Kadat said, a less intrusive manner, and it also streamlines our services, allowing us to have cross-gender supervision, so males can take samples on females and female officers can take samples from male offenders as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 99? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 99, and we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 94.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 94 comes to you from the Department of Veterans Affairs. It authorizes the Director of Veterans Affairs to require fingerprints of certain specified persons for the purposes of requesting a statewide or national guard criminal records check that are either employed by or contractors of the Department of Veterans Affairs.
All right, thank you. Jim Lewis.
When you're ready.
Members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 94, which amends ORS 406050 and gives the Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs the authority to request fingerprints of certain employees and contractors, vendors, for the purpose of conducting background investigations under ORS 181534. The department has determined that due to the confidential nature of the document it maintains, such as Social Security numbers, private medical records, DD-214 military discharge documents, financial disclosure information, and tax information, that certain employees, as well as some doing business with the department, should have criminal background checks for security purposes. Currently, the department has the authority to conduct criminal background checks on employees accessing the Oregon Veterans Home as a security measure to protect patients. However, the department does not have overarching authority to conduct these background checks on other areas of the agency where security is necessary. The new authority would only be applied to new employees, not existing employees. Senate Bill 94 is a housekeeping bill that will allow the department to request fingerprint and conduct criminal background checks as needed by the department and is in compliance with House Bill 2252, which passed during the 2007 session, giving similar abilities to other state agencies. I'd like to thank you for your consideration of this bill, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right. Any questions? Jim, thank you very much. Oh, wait, Council?
Not a question, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Henry Myers brought to my attention last Friday something in the bill, and I talked to Tom Mann about it, and I had a call in the Legislative Council's office about it, too. If you look at the bill on Section 1A and B, it applies to all employers and contractors of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Then when you look at Section 2, it's more specific as it relates to employers of the department. And I'm trying to, as I said, I have a call into the draft of the bill to try to figure out the relationship between the two. One is broader than the other.
All right. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also want to ask, Mr. Willis, have you had an opportunity to review the written testimony of the ACLU?
I have not, Senator, no.
Okay, because they also raised a concern about the date of birth information and also wondered about the, there's an emergency clause in the bill that would have it take effect immediately upon signing, and I just want to reiterate the concern that was brought forth in this testimony from the ACLU about how there would be some need for rulemaking to set forth the procedures to collect and protect this information, and their concern about having the adequate time to make those rules if there's an emergency clause. I just wanted to ask if you had any concerns about that as well.
Chair Przanski and Senator Bonamici, I don't have a concern about that. I'm very familiar with the criminal background investigations from my prior service in the state police, and I think that our agency is all about maintaining confidentiality of information, which is one of the reasons why we want to make sure that we hire people who have a demonstrated strength of character and background that would allow us to be sure that they will treat this information with respect and confidentiality.
Thank you.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Mr. Willis, just a quick question. What will happen to the fingerprints, their fingerprint record, after you are through with them? First, And secondly, will these fingerprint records go to the FBI, and at that point in time, will they become a permanent record?
Chair Przanski and Senator Whitsitt, let me respond to the first part of your question. As I understand it, the fingerprint cards are archived, and they are protected as a public record. The second part of your question was about the FBI, and I didn't quite understand what you were asking me.
Would they be retained by the FBI in perpetuity as well?
Chair Przanski and Senator Whitsitt, the FBI would retain the fact that the inquiry is made as to a criminal history and whether or not that was provided. As far as who requested it, I believe that would come from the Oregon State Bureau of Identification and Investigation.
All right. Jim, I have one other question, and that's regarding, we had another bill last week regarding expansion of fingerprint checks, background checks, I should say. And in that situation, I think that was with the Department of Human Services, maybe with the State Hospital, if I'm not mistaken. But we had a discussion as to how broad this would be for vendors. And my understanding from their perspective, this would be a vendor that is ongoing as compared to someone that's bringing in something like supplies. In other words, I would expect that you're not going to be wanting to do a background check on a delivery person for a office supply store. Is that correct?
Chair Przanski, that's correct, and let me give you an example of what we would want to do. We are required in many instances and several times a year to be audited, sometimes by the Secretary of State, which is, of course, an internal state agency, sometimes by our own employed internal auditor, so that's not an issue. But when we must hire an outside company to do the auditing of the agency, I believe that's a vendor that we would want to check out, because of their access to the department records.
Great. Thank you for putting that on the record.
Yes, sir.
The other thing I want to just put on the record is that we do have written testimony that is in opposition from Andrea Meyer at the ACLU. According to my note, she had to be in another hearing this morning, and so she chose to do her testimony today in writing. So that's part of the record for those who want that. I assume there's copies over on the table. Any other questions? Senator Bonamici.
Just a concern, and I'm sorry if Counsel Taylor already put this concern on the record, but I do appreciate the limitations that are listed in Section 2 about when the control over and access to information, secure information, confidential information, but it does look like those limitations only apply to employees or prospective employees, not to the contractors, subcontractors, vendors, or volunteers. So.
Let me tell you, the chair's perspective on this is I do want to get some clarification, make sure we have everything as we want it, make sure we don't have unintended consequences. So with counsel making the inquiry of LC, we'll wait until we hear back from the drafter, and if it's necessary to do any type of clarification through amendments, I would expect that we will put those together, making sure Mr. Willis has an opportunity to review them before we bring it back. Counsel?
Mr. Chair, I'll talk agency afterwards to get an idea of what the scope they want. Or do they want it to all employees, or do they want it to specific employees? And that will probably give an idea of how the bill will be amended.
Okay. That would be great. All right. If there's, Mr. Willis, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 94? Not seeing one coming forward. We'll close that public hearing, and we're now going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 93.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 93 comes to you at the request of the governor, and I believe allows the state court administrator to enter an agreement with the United States Financial Management Services and the Internal Revenue Service for the purpose of attaching federal tax refunds in order to satisfy debts the taxpayer owes to the state courts. Allows the courts to add a fee to recover costs associated with collecting. Takes effect upon passage.
All right, great. Looks like we have six people that are scheduled to give testimony. I'll call them up in a panel. Kevin Campbell, Phil Lemon, and Brian DeLastman will be the first panel. The second one is Eric, I guess, Gablick, I guess it is, and Tim Nesbitt, who will probably be Joe O'Leary instead. Oh, right. So, Joe, why don't you wait? We'll come back and get you on the second set. Unless you want everyone up together, you can bring another chair up. That'll be just the four. Yeah. A little more cozy, but it is Monday morning as compared to Friday.
Chair Prasansky, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, good morning. For the record, I'm Joe O'Leary, Governor Kulongoski's Public Safety Advisor, and I'm going to make 3 points here in support of Senate Bill 93. I'm going to hand out to you an exhibit. My testimony today on behalf of Governor Kulongoski is in support of Senate Bill 93, which I have had an opportunity to talk to some of you about prior to today. This is a measure that would allow the state of Oregon to tap into the federal tax returns of individuals who owe unpaid fines and fees that have been court-ordered in criminal court throughout Oregon. And you will hear testimony from the folks who understand the numbers better than I, but the bottom line is that if Congress provides the authorization for Oregon and the other states to tap into these federal tax returns of offenders who owe fines and fees, Oregon will see huge benefits. On the executive branch side, Oregon will see huge benefits to the and support to the budgets that provide public safety training at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, that the budgets within the Department of Justice that provide support for victim assistance programs in local district attorney offices and child abuse assessment centers throughout the state, and for law enforcement investigation through the Oregon State Police. It is also a credibility issue. It's an issue that goes to the credibility of the system in that more court-ordered fines and fees will be made good and be paid. This was a recommendation that came out of the Governor's Forest Payments Task Force that was convened about a year ago jointly with the Association of Oregon Counties. The task force was chaired by the Governor's Deputy Chief of Staff, Tim Nesbitt, and by then Lane County Commissioner Bobby Green. And the exhibit that I forward to you contains the recommendations of that work group, whose report is actually being published this week and will be probably available to you by Friday of this week. But I've given you an excerpt, which is the recommendation of the subgroup of that task force that dealt with issues related to courts and district attorneys. I was the facilitator of that task force, and you will see this issue discussed at page 67, which is the third page into this handout. At the bottom of page 67, the recommendation around collection of unpaid fines and fees to benefit both counties and the state. And I should not neglect to add that it will also be a benefit to victim restitution payments, which also flow from this revenue source. The last thing I want to mention to you is that the bill before you is contingent on federal action. And there have been now two efforts in Congress to create the momentum around this issue and to allow the states to intercept these tax returns. In the 101st Congress, that's the last session of Congress, it was House Bill 6172 and Senate Bill 1287. Senate Bill 1287 was introduced by Senator Gordon Smith. It's the Crime Victim Restitution and Court Intercept Bill. And we understand from Senator Wyden's office that Senator Wyden will be introducing that provision again. Senator Sessions, who was one of the co-sponsors in the Senate, is also going to be introducing that again. And I know that there are several national organizations, including the Center for State Courts, the National District Attorneys Associations, and others who are interested in joining in the momentum, especially now at a time when Congress is talking about support to the states. This, to my mind, seems like a no-brainer where Congress can give the states the ability to intercept these tax returns at no cost to the federal government. The last thing I want to tell you is that I was authorized by the Oregon State Bar, by the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and by the Benton County Commissioners to convey to you that they are also supportive of this measure. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Phil Lemon, with your permission, who is representing the Chief Justice.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Phil Lemon from the Oregon Judicial Department. As Mr. O'Leary said, Senate Bill 93 creates the state statutory authority for the Judicial Department to intercept federal tax refunds owed to Oregonians to enforce all financial obligations ordered by state courts. Just to briefly talk about the Judicial Department's position, this is a personal priority for the Chief Justice and the Department, both at the state and federal levels. The main interest that we have is to, we base all our work on the assumption that justice has not fully been served until all aspects of the court judgment, including these financial obligations, have been enforced. And so I've submitted written testimony that outlines what we believe the impact of Senate Bill 93 and the related federal actions would be if in place for the entire 09-11 biennium, which, by the way, it will not be because of timing issues. But if it were and would be in place, the entire 09-11 biennium, we believe we would add about $61 million both to public safety service funding and to restitution to crime victims. And all the money that we collect is authorized by a state statute that is imposed by the courts, and then it's up to us and the executive branch agencies to collect these things. So I would urge you to support this, and we will come back to you with reports on our federal activities as well.
Kevin? Chair Pazanski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and we join the Governor's Office and other public safety partners in supporting Senate Bill 93. I wanted to mention just for a minute some of the benefits or recipients that would benefit from this increased revenue. In 2005, House Bill 3497 was passed. It created a prioritization of the criminal fines and assessments account. That's an account that funds what we now call system critical elements of public safety. They include public safety training. They include forensic services, includes the LED system. It includes the medical examiners and critical victims programs. These are programs really that agencies, both city and county throughout the state, depend on, absolutely, in order for this justice system to work. The reason for the bill in 2005 actually was created in 2003 when a funding crisis similar to the one today, albeit not quite as bad, resulted in deep cuts to the forensic. It was a cut that resulted in literally creating a choke point in the public safety system. This funding that would be created through the ability to collect through this intercept bill, this federal intercept, would create the opportunity to fully fund those important critical system critical elements of public safety that all of us depend on. When the state can't fund public safety basic training, when they can't fully fund our LED system or the medical examiner or forensics, the rest of the system stops. And so I would encourage you to support Senate Bill 93 and the critical funding that would result for our system critical elements of public safety. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time. All right, thank you. Brian?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Brian DeLeishman, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. I appreciate Joe O'Leary from the Governor's Office pointing this bill out to me. It was not one that was immediately on my radar screen, but after looking at it and sending it to my clients, they have taken a position in support of that, at least the Oregon Council of Police Associations. The Oregon State Police Officers Association, your state troopers, also will be making a determination on this, and I fully expect that they would be supporting the bill as well. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. With your permission, may I also just note for the record that both the League of Oregon Cities and the City of Portland also asked me to express their support for the bill in committee.
All right, thank you. Chair, as long as we're adding, can I put one on?
Sure, why not?
The Oregon Collectors Association also has authorized me to say that they support the bill as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Boquist first.
I just want to clarify for the record, Mr. Chair, I mean, I don't have a problem with the bill, and it actually appears to be a pretty good idea, but I think for the record, there is no revenue impact because this is a mythical bill or a mystical bill at this point. It would not come into effect until the federal law and the Congress acted. On that point, if it was a no-brainer, they would have already done it, because this has been before the Congress several times before. I mean, there are all kinds of there's a plethora of challenges at the federal level, state level with identity theft and the IRS in implementing this. So while I'm supportive of the conceptual idea, it really will do nothing for the next biennium. It's only one of those boxes that it's a what if the federal legislation was actually passed. So, and for that reason, I would ask counsel, I'm assuming there's no revenue impact because, frankly, there is no revenue impact until such time the federal government acts. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one reason I was out of the room was to see if I could get a fiscal and revenue impact statement. I don't have that. I would prefer to leave the revenue impact issue to the revenue committee. Obviously, if we can't collect anything because we need a federal law and it's not passed, then we don't collect anything.
Right.
But I could say if federal law comes into effect, then we'd be first in line to collect.
All right, gentlemen, thank you very much. Eric?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Skablix. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. I'll keep my comments brief. I don't want to repeat what's already been said. DPSST is one of the critical public safety elements named in the legislation that's been discussed. Our criminal justice training and certifications programs rely exclusively on the criminal fines and assessments for our funding. Unfortunately, right now, with the economic downturn and increased hirings by local agencies, we have more than a 90-day backlog of getting officers into the basic training academy. So this bill alleviates some of that concern. And the other thing I think it's important to share is the state-local partnership that's created within criminal fines and assessments. That is, when a city, a county, or the state hires a police officer, that employer is obligated to pay the salaries of those officers coming to the academy, but the state pickup, if you will, is that we provide that training free of cost from the CFAA. So we ask you to consider that as you look at this bill. So thank you for your time.
Stay seated. Any questions? Senator Boquist.
Just, Mr. Chair, a follow-up comment, because I want to make sure everybody is clear here, is that this isn't money we can spend because the federal government doesn't allow it under the law. So there's a lot of people testifying that this is a good idea and we want this revenue, but it's not revenue we can count on our revenue stream.
All right. All right. Any other comments or statements? Anyone else want to give testimony on Senate Bill 93? Eric, why don't you just stay right where you're at? All right. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 93. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 92. And, Council, if you give us an overview.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 92 comes to you at the request of Governor Ted Kulongoski for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, authorizes the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to conduct research to improve police, fire, corrections, parole, probation, emergency, medical dispatch, and telecommunications professional services.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of
the committee. Again, for the record, Eric Skablix, Deputy Director for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. We introduced Senate Bill 92 to do two things. One is to allow our agency to conduct research. Currently, we could be a partner in research entities, and we've done that, but we cannot conduct any of our own research at the Public Safety Academy. The other thing it does is it adds telecommunicators and emergency medical dispatchers to that group of professions, which was really an oversight years ago when that discipline was added to our mission. So I'd be glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Questions? I don't see any questions. So anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 92? Not seeing anyone, will close the public hearing. And Council, let's walk through what we have available for a work session.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have both statements available for Senate Bill 92.
All right, we're going to start off with a work session for Senate Bill 92. And the chair will entertain a motion regarding that bill. There is none.
Okay.
No impact. So can the chair have a motion on Senate Bill 92?
You're too sick to talk. Mr. Chair.
You should probably move down another slide.
Right. I just want to make sure.
Yeah.
Okay, got it. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 92 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Broquest moves Senate Bill 92 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussions? Any objection? So ordered. We'll close the work session with Senate Bill 92. And a carrier will be Senator Brokwist. Why don't you take this one?
No, I'll tell you what. Senator Wissetz, he's over here. He needs to catch up. I've got to keep
him. I really don't want to carry this one.
All right, I understand. And then I think the next one is 99.
Chair members of the committee, 93 do not have the information ready yet. 94, we have some work to do on the chair members of the committee. It will be Senate Bill 99.
All right, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 99. And this is the one that would allow for the modification of testing people on probations. Senator Boquist.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 99 to the floor with due pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 99 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
And I'm on board with this one, Mr. Chair. So I'm
and Senator Brokwist will be our carry on this one. We'll close the public, the work session on Senate Bill 99, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 100. And this is the one that would allow for
That's correct, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We have the information on that. We have the Dash 1 amendments in front of you, but they're not being moved at the board.
Right. Yeah, my understanding, this is basically going to go as written without the Dash 1s, and this will just allow for the actual cost studies to be performed every 6 years, starting in 2012.
And is there no fiscal impact on
that? Chair, members of the committee, it has a minimal fiscal impact and has no revenue impact.
And so the chair would take a motion on 100.
All right, Mr. Chair. I'll move Senate Bill 100 to the floor with a due pass.
All right. Senator Brokwist so kindly on a Monday has moved Senate Bill 100 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions?
Just a quick discussion, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. I do see this. I understand this came out of the task force, and I kind of see it as marginal because it has no teeth. And I'm concerned we're studying this study and the counties won't actually have an impact afterwards, but I suppose if they want it in statute, then it's a good idea.
Yeah, and I share your thoughts, but I expect that based on what's on the record that the Department of Corrections as well as the state will in fact provide itself to fund at the level that are determined to be the actual cost. If not, then I expect there'll be a lot of buses being loaded up, and we'll be bringing them back up here.
You're precise, right, Mr. Chair.
In the hearing room, right?
Yeah. They'll not only be in the hearing room, they'll be everywhere. Any other questions, discussions, any objections? Not hearing any. So forward, and I will be the carry on Senate Bill 100. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 100. And, Council, I believe that takes care of what we need to do.
That's probably all that can be worked today.
All right. Thank you, everyone. We'll close the Senate Committee on Judiciary and adjourn for the day. I expect we'll be here tomorrow at 8:30 based on our schedules. So please check that, but I believe it's an 8:30 start. Thank you.